We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Well, it is Wednesday, October 16th, and early voting starts in a lot of states, including Georgia, and we're going to get to an important election integrity ruling yesterday later on in the program. But first, where are the Christians at? Because there is a new Barna survey that is suggesting that so many Christians, millions of voters, are not going to go to the polls this election and vote their values. And this is a tragedy for America, because even though, you know, there are a lot of reasons why we could say, yeah, it's, you know, the lesser of the two evils, you can have all of those philosophical debates, whether or not you want to abstain for a moral reason for one or more of the elections, there's so much more on the ballot. For example, in my home state of Florida, and in nine other states, abortion is on the ballot, and these absolutely terrible, extreme initiatives that are trying to cement a so-called right to abortion in state constitutions, at least go out and vote for that, if nothing else. But Christians should be participating in our civil government. And so my good friend Ryan Helfenbein, who is the executive director for the Standing for Freedom Center, talked about this on his program, That's the Point, which you should be following the Freedom Center on X, so that you can get these about, you know, 5 or 6 minute cuts that really just focus on the main point and drive it home. Here is part of what he had to say.
Are more than 32 million Christians ducking the 2024 election? How should Christians and pastors think about this? More importantly, what should they do? Here's the point. According to new research by George Barna's Cultural Research Center, there are some 51% of people of faith who plan not to vote in the 2024 presidential election. That means some 104 million people who are eligible voters do not plan to vote. 104 million is a huge number, but how many actually attend church? According to Barna, some 32 million self-identified Christians regularly attend church services who do not plan to vote, and roughly 14 million evangelicals who regularly attend church services are expected not to vote. There are a number of critically important issues that will be determined by this election and are not being discussed in churches today. While nearly 2 out of 3 churches already address issues like religious liberty and wealth and poverty from the pulpit, many other critical topics are being left out. Did you know less than 50% of pulpits in America discuss abortion, law and order, same-sex marriage, the role of government, the current Israeli conflict, transgenderism, and the LGBT movement, and immigration and border security? According to Dr. Barna, pastors are the single greatest influence on whether Christians will vote in this election.
All right, so Ryan Helfenbein joins me now. So Ryan, this is a really shocking survey, honestly. And do you attribute this mainly to pastors not influencing their congregations to go out and vote?
I do. I think while certainly people will reflect upon the candidates, and that's true in every election, that there's always much to be desired, right? Because Christ is not on the ballot. At the end of the day, you do have pastors who are not speaking to the most important issues of the day using scripture. or rather preaching the whole counsel of God, making sure that no stone is unturned, and those issues will actually be addressed if they would just methodically go verse by verse through the Bible.
Yeah, and you know, I had a commentator who I don't think is a Christian based on his profile, but you know, somebody who interacts with me on social media quite a bit, and was saying, you know, in response to me reposting your video, which was very well done, saying, you know, pastors shouldn't engage politics, otherwise, you know, they should have to pay taxes. And that's, of course, the kind of the knee-jerk reaction from a lot of the left, or people who don't actually understand what tax exempt means, and that we don't have to pay for our privilege to engage in civil government. It's actually a right that's secured in the First Amendment, among other places, and even for pastors to talk about these things from the pulpit. But it seems like so many pastors are shying away, not just because of, you know, the IRS or tax exempt status, but because they don't want to offend their congregations. And they think, well, you know, we may have some LGBTQ affirming people in the congregation, or we may have some people who knows their life circumstances, or, you know, what they think about abortion. And so they tend to do these topical sermons, and this isn't every church, obviously, but a lot of kind of what I would call these, you know, mega church pastors who are more focused on the bottom line and growing their numbers instead of preaching the word of God, they don't want to offend. And that is really dangerous when it comes to living the Christian life fully, which includes engaging in our civil government.
Right. No, that's exactly right. You know, I think there are many pastors today, unfortunately, that are uncomfortable with the language of conflict. They're uncomfortable with the language of division. Jesus said, I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword to divide and even divide households against one another. The gospel is divisive. It does divide sheep from goats. And we have to recognize that Jesus says in Matthew 12, he who is not with me is against me. He did come to bring a kind of conflict. And when you are delineating truth from falsehood, delineating between right and wrong, when you are rightly dividing the word of truth as a pastor speaking in the pulpit, you will bring upon that congregation a level of conflict depending on the health of that church. And so some people are sitting in the pews completely comfortable, and they need to be afflicted. They need to be afflicted with righteous truth. And by the way, that is loving. That is not unloving. Speak the truth in love, and also speak the truth truthfully. And I think there are a lot of pastors today, sadly, it's a product of our culture. It's not anything that has come from Scripture, but there's a kind of methodology that is being used not to offend. And people are skirting the truth. And these political issues are just a byproduct of that. We're seeing that in our culture today. It really is true that Christianity or religion is north even of culture. It influences and shapes culture. And then culture in turn influences and shapes politics. Politics is last in that line of rail cars. So it really does come from the pulpit. The pulpit itself can shape the conscience of the nation, the soul of the nation. So it really does start with what's happening in local churches.
Yeah, that's so well said. My special guest, Ryan Helfenbein, the executive director of the Standing for Freedom Center at Liberty University. And the numbers that Dr. Barna put out are staggering. And this would, in a lot of instances, I mean, you know, whether the tens of millions are wherever they're located across the nation, that is still a hugely significant number and likely would be outcome determinative for a lot of the elections all the way down ballot, and certainly some of these initiatives, especially when we're seeing that some of the races are called with just a couple of thousand or even 10,000 vote margins. So how significant is this with early voting now starting in a lot of different states and leading up to the 2024 election, that Christians understand our duty before the Lord to engage in civil government with truth, and that includes if we are American citizens and eligible with our vote?
Yeah, well said. You know, look, last election, was determined by less than 600,000 votes in nine key battleground states, so something like 587,000 votes. According to Barna's research, this could be completely determined by local congregations where pastors get up in the pulpit and encourage, not tell people exactly how to vote, but encourage everyone in the congregation to get registered and to participate and basically vote the scripture, vote the Bible. Sometimes I hear vote your conscience. I'm not always comfortable with that because some people's consciences have been seared. But vote Bible, vote biblical principles and biblical values. A pastor, so we're talking about 600,000 votes. There's roughly 14 million evangelicals who won't participate in this election. And these are evangelicals who attend church semi-regularly to regularly. There absolutely are votes that are being left on the table. And my thing is this. I'm looking at two candidates in particular. And the question I ask myself, Jenna, is, look, at the end of the day, there's a lot to be desired when you consider all that could be potentially out there. You think about all the different governors that are out there and those that are in the Senate who could potentially be running. But at the end of the day, we have two options. It's very simple for me. Who would I rather have a debate with? Who would I rather be talking to about border and security, about the issue of life, about IVF? About the economy, who would I rather be having that debate with? And I was thinking, even reflecting this morning, someone who holds to rectilinear logic, someone who believes in 2 + 2 = 4, that there is such a thing in the universe as right triangles, and right triangles are 90 degrees. People who have some objective-based understanding of reality, I can have a debate with that person. I can't have a debate with someone who doesn't believe in those things and then actually evades those things and dodges those things, in terms of a personal philosophy, moral philosophy, doesn't actually believe in any kind of category of truth. That is going to be very difficult to have any kind of productive conversation with. And it's going to be difficult for that person to govern because they don't believe in any kind of category of truth. So we're seeing that right now. This is a battle of worldviews. The reason why these elections are becoming increasingly more critical is because you really do have two ideologically opposed worldviews battling it out in the ballot, in the Electoral College, two completely different governing philosophies. And I will say that there is one category that it still believes in truth, believes in right triangles and 2 + 2 = 4, in some kind of objective-based morality. That is a place where you can have productive conversations. That is a place where you can have debate. And so we need to recognize as Christians, as people of the truth, that there is no equivocation between these two options that we have that are running for president.
Yeah,
one is absolute. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I could not agree more that this is a battle of worldviews. And that's true from the top of the ticket all the way down, because even if you look at some of these initiatives in the states that are being funded by George Soros, Planned Parenthood, and the left versus what, some of these really great red state governors like Governor DeSantis, who will stand for life, and what the worldview difference is, even on a ballot initiative where it's not a personality running, it's just the issue itself. That is a stark contrast as well. And where do you think that churches need to point this out more? Because what I'm seeing, Ryan, so much with the objections from Christians saying, oh, we don't want to get into politics, it's too dirty, or, the pastor shouldn't be talking about politics from the pulpit, is that they fail to understand that the Christian life is all about engaging in our life, in our society. And early Christians lived in a purely pagan society, and God still told them, this is everything that I've commanded you for how to live out your Christian life, even in the midst of whatever is going on in the culture. So where are we failing to connect those dots as the church more broadly?
I think, and I'm gonna put it like this, and pastors all across the country are responsible primarily for three things. They got to preach the word. They got to marry people and counsel people in marriage, and they also have to bury people and counsel people who are grieving, people who have just experienced a loss of life. There are pastors all across the country that have been impacted in their local congregations by the issues that are actually directly confronted on the ballot. There are pastors across the country that have had to bury people, put people in the ground as a result of fentanyl, who've had to deal with issues regarding border security. You think about Lake and Riley. Who conducted that funeral? There was a pastor there, I guarantee you. When there are shootings, when there are, you know, there are issues even being dealt with, you know, in counseling, post-abortive mothers, there are pastors that are there that have to stand in that gap. I think it's an issue where some pastors have to be honest with even with others in what these issues are. These are life and death kind of situations, and we have to be honest about what's happening. We cannot play into the moral equivalency that the enemy uses. And when I say the enemy, I'm talking about the devil, the half-God said, trying to pretend as though we have two options that are absolutely the same, weights and measures and means, all of it is the same, and really a Christian could go either way. And that's not true. We know that's not true. That's a categorical lie. I wouldn't trust any pastor who would say that from the pulpit or believe that. I think it's disqualified as somebody who could effectively minister as a gospel minister. So I think that we have to be honest about the life or death situations that are truly on the ballot. And I'm thinking about, you know, a big category, of course, is abortion, but then even other issues. Immigration is a big one. Border security is a big one. 20% of people in the United States right now, foreign-born. There are literally people who have come across, smuggled across the border from all across the world. We can't account for who these people are. Soon enough, we might know, and I'm afraid in the worst ways possible. We have to recognize that these are policies which are impacted by politics, which actually impact people. And so people matter. And the way we love our neighbor, starting with pastors and those in congregations, is to vote rightly. We have to recognize that there are dire straits and difficult choices we have to make.
And we have to stand up for truth at every turn. And I'm so grateful that you do that each and every day at the Standing for Freedom Center. Ryan Helfenbein, thank you so much for this. You can follow him at rhelfenbein on X and also the Standing for Freedom Center at Freedom Center LU. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And speaking of the election, the Georgia early voting starts today, among other states. And just yesterday, a judge in Georgia ruled that election officials must certify vote counts even if they suspect fraud. This headline coming from Fox News. But there is a little bit more to this story that Fox seemed to leave out. So joining us now to discuss all this and more is Cleta Mitchell, who is a senior legal fellow at the Conservative Partnership Institute and the founder of the Election Integrity Network. So, Cleta, what is really going on with this decision and election integrity based out of Georgia?
Well, hi, Jenna. Thanks so much for having me. This case began back in, it really started back in February when the Fulton County Republican board member on the Board of Registration Elections in Fulton County, which oversees the elections of Fulton County. There are five members, and one is appointed, nominated by the County Republican Party. And the person that the County Republican Party had nominated a year earlier, the county commissioners, controlled by the Democrats in Fulton County, refused to confirm his nomination for the first time ever. And finally, after this impasse, the county party nominated a new person to be their representative, one of their two representatives on the Fulton County Election Board. And her name is Julie Adams, and she's one of the leaders, the election integrity leaders in Georgia. And she immediately, she's very knowledgeable about elections and has been a poll watcher, does all the training for the poll observers all over the state. And so she immediately, this was just prior to the presidential preference primary in February, and she immediately sent a note to an email to the supervisor of elections saying, here are the documents that I need to see. I'd like to be at these places. And, you know, because she knows what to ask for. She's knowledgeable. And they told her no, that she couldn't see anything, that she had no access to anything. And she goes, wait a minute, I'm on the board. I have to certify the election, and you aren't going to let me see anything. And so this saga went on for several months. And so in May, she filed a lawsuit, the America First Policy Institute, AFPI, Center for Litigation, representing her, filed a lawsuit in May saying we have to, that she's entitled to see, she's a member of the board, she's entitled to see anything and everything because she has to sign she took an oath that she was certifying the result is true and correct, and she couldn't possibly do that unless she was able to have access to the election materials. And the Democratic Party, and so she voted no on certifying the presidential preference primary results in February because they wouldn't let her see anything, and she abstained in certifying the results in May of the regular primary because they wouldn't let her see anything. They gave her 6 hours where she could walk around and try to see things and then have a meeting to certify. I mean, it was bizarre. So she filed a suit, and then immediately the DNC, Democratic National Committee, and State Democratic Party of Georgia intervened, and they said they moved to intervene in the case, saying she had no choice, but she had to certify the elections no matter what. And so there was a hearing 2 weeks ago. Now, mind you, this is a note this, Jenna. That suit, she filed that suit in May. Three judges recused. She did not get a judge to hear the case appointed until August. Does this sound familiar? This is what happened to President Trump in the post-election in 2020, where his election contest was filed and no judge was appointed to be able to hear the case. So there's a long history in Fulton County, Georgia, of not acting quickly to hear election disputes. Unless you're a Democrat, then they move very quickly. And anyway, the hearing was finally held 2 weeks ago. And the Democrats' argument is that certification is mandatory, that the members must vote on certification at a given time, no matter what. And so the judge ruled yesterday, or David, he issued the order Monday night, but didn't get out until yesterday. And all the media has focused on is that there's this statutory deadline of 5 p.m. the Monday following the election that they must meet and certify. And he says, oh, man, it's mandatory that they certify. Now, I still don't, that still mystifies me. However, he issued an order that is, to me, the most important part of the order, which says she is entitled to everything. In fact, she has a duty to inspect all the books and records and have access to the voting procedures. And he specifically said, the judge specifically says, that as a board member, she has a statutory duty to cross-check the results and have access to do that. And that's the part the media has completely missed. Because, of course, the media has been taken the position, what they always do, they echo Mark Elias. And this is a theory he concocted about 3 years ago, that that certification of the election results is mandatory, not a discretionary act on the part of election judges. To me, that's an issue that we can deal with. But what it does say is that election board members all over the country, if this is applied universally, that they have access and that the bureaucrats cannot just hide everything and tell the essentially the people who are supposed to have oversight, oh, we're, you know, you don't have any right to see what we're doing. To me, that's the more important part of the decision, the part that nobody's actually paying attention to.
Yeah, and Cleta Mitchell, this seems like it makes just so much sense and it shouldn't be controversial. But of course, we know that election integrity has become, you know, this very highly partisan argument. But I mean, anyone who is a judge in any capacity needs to see and hear the evidence and then render a decision based on what they see. I mean, and so to even have some sort of argument that in her capacity, she's not entitled to that. I mean, that seems like it would be so obvious. I mean, are there other states besides Georgia where that was the process and practice that these judges just had to rubber stamp it rather than actually looking into what exactly they're certifying?
Well, yes, this has become actually a thing, and I'm very serious. This is a Mark Elias theory that he concocted after the 2020 election. And you would not believe the amount of money, the number of groups. It's a typical, once they decide on a thing, whatever that is, they pour all kinds of money into promoting it. And so what you have in the state of Michigan, for instance, historically, the elections in Michigan are run by, they're administered by a town clerk, an elected town clerk. And it's very decentralized. There are something like, I think, 1,300 of them, similar to Wisconsin, which also has about 1,800 local clerks who run the elections. But in Michigan, they have historically had a bipartisan board of canvassers whose statutory duty is to review the returns presented by the town clerk, to look at what's been done, and then to certify the election. And what they've done in Michigan is the Democrat-controlled legislature passed a bill that essentially neuters or gets rid of, for all practical purposes, the oversight responsibilities of the canvassing board members, who have been a check and balance because it's Democrats and Republicans watching each other, and has basically neutered and demolished the system of oversight so that the town clerk has really nobody overseeing by what they're doing. And in Arizona, we know that there were two board of supervisors members, or the election board members, in a small county in Arizona who were concerned in the general election of 2022 about the conduct of the election, refused to certify. They have been indicted criminally. They're facing criminal charges for saying, wait a minute, this isn't right, there's something wrong here, and refusing and voting no on certification. So this is something that the left is, I call it the deep state in elections, It's the Fauciizing. You know, just trust the experts. Don't ask questions. Just accept whatever you're told. And they hate the idea. The left hates the idea of citizen oversight. They hate the idea of parents overseeing school boards and looking at what's going on in school libraries and curriculum. They hate the idea of citizens looking over the shoulders of election officials to make sure that the voter rolls, for instance, are clean, making sure that the systems are run properly, that the election technology is not being susceptible to hacking or manipulation. The election integrity movement, in a nutshell, is fighting against this deep state in elections. So to me, the bigger point of this decision is that the judge said that the board members have the right to see everything and, in fact, a statutory duty to cross-check everything. I think that's hugely important.
I'm speaking with Cleta Mitchell, who is also the founder of the Election Integrity Network, and you can go to whoscounting.us, and also listen to her podcast, which is very important, covers in detail a lot of these things that are very critical to election integrity. And what you're just saying, Cleta, it sounds like, you know, these elitists and the left don't actually want a self-government. They don't want a citizen-run government. They don't want anyone questioning anything that they do. They just want to be able to manipulate the process however they prefer, and have the powers that be in these actual elected officials and judges to just rubber stamp whatever they want to do, so that they can continue to just put people in positions of power that they prefer. And so the last question I have for you is, you know, 3 weeks out from the 2024 election, and so much emphasis on election integrity that has come to the fore, especially in the last 4 years, has progress been made on a lot of these issues, like what you're describing in Georgia? That good, there's access for, you know, judges, for example, and that's a good thing. Has there been enough progress on these issues in some of these key battleground states that you have more faith in the integrity of the 2024 election than maybe elections prior?
Well, I think the short answer is yes, we've made a lot of progress. But you have to remember, Jenna, the Capital Research Center has estimated that the left has raised and spent between $10 and $15 billion over the last decade changing the way Americans vote. There are, in fact, one thing I was going to mention, there are ballot issues on the ballots in all across the country that would upend the election processes in the states. In fact, we just launched yesterday a new website. It's called Vote Fair, F-A-I-R, 2024, and it is an interactive map. It's votefair2024.com, and it is an interactive map that shows you where in the country, that if you could go and look at your state, do you have a ballot issue, or one or two or three, like in Idaho, I think they have three to five, that would change the way voting is conducted in the state. And these left-wing groups are well bankrolled, and they have put these ballot measures on, and they're outspending our side like $9 million to $200,000. But people should go and look and find out and learn about, do you have a ballot issue that is going to be on your ballot, and how should you vote on that? There are 8 states that have ballot issues that should be passed that are state constitutional amendments to say only citizens can vote in the elections in this state. We need those to pass. Wisconsin, the League of Women Voters, and a bunch of 30-something left-wing groups have signed on to fight the ballot amendment that would prohibit non-citizens from voting in Wisconsin. So these are battles that we are having that we never had before. They could do these things with impunity. Now we have literally tens of thousands of volunteers, patriots, good-hearted Americans who want to save our country by saving our elections. And for those Christians who are listening, I want to tell you that if you do not register and vote, you are giving your consent. By not voting, by not participating, you are giving your consent to men and women's sports, boys and girls' bathrooms, transgender mutilation of children surgeries that are happening all over the country. You're giving your consent to the left-wing hatred of Israel. I just saw polling data yesterday that said that 51% of people who would self-identify as people of faith are not planning to vote. Jenna, that cohort of people in our country have it in their power to save the country. And so I hope, Jenna, between now and the election, you will talk about the importance. And voter registration is closing in many states. So people of faith need to get up and register and vote, because if we do not, I fear that we will not be able to have elections in our future, that they will be completely over. The system will have pretend elections like they had in the Soviet Union and like they have in Venezuela. I'm very concerned about that, and I cannot say strongly enough, register and vote.
Thank you so much for that admonition, Cleta. Absolutely. And this is why we're talking about all of this this morning. And Christians, God's people who are Christ followers, you need to get out and vote, because this isn't, as we talked about in the first segment, just about, you know, some of these abortion initiatives and things that you should be voting your values on. But as Cleta mentioned, I mean, if you go to votefair2024.com, I mean, I'm looking at the map of like 20 states that have these election integrity issues that are on the ballot. My former home state of Colorado is one of those, that the state constitutional amendment that only citizens can vote. That's a good thing. That should pass in that state. That's like the SAVE Act. So go to votefair2024.com and make sure that you know the issues in your state. Get out and vote your values. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, Mark Robinson, who is the GOP candidate for governor of North Carolina, one of the swing states as well in the 2024 election, has sued CNN over a report that is linking him to lewd comments on a pornographic website. And this coming from the New York Times this morning. Robinson's campaign for governor of North Carolina has been in crisis since the report, which the lawsuit calls recklessly false. So, my take on this is that this is maybe a little bit more of a PR move heading into November and 3 weeks out, because he's not going to get a hearing, you know, or any resolution within 3 weeks at all. So is this more to help his campaign? Well, let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, I'm being told that we are trying to reconnect with the guests, so sorry about that. But Gerard Folletti will join us momentarily. But basically, as I've said, and we'll get his take on this, is that even though this is a swing state, and it could be that that CNN published this report to tank the campaign, you know, we'll see what the merits of this lawsuit actually are. For this lawsuit to be filed at this point in time seems like a PR move, because there's going to be no resolution before the election. But will that lawsuit then actually help his potential chances and overall how Donald Trump does in North Carolina, which I think that he needs in terms of his electoral count? And I'm being told that our guest is as soon as I try to welcome him in, he's gone. So we're trying to connect with Gerard. But this is live radio for you, right? So Devin and Adam are working really hard for this. But but North Carolina is going to be a very interesting swing state, and especially with the impact of. Are we sure he's ready? Are we sure? Because if I go to him and then he's not again, you know, we'll see. But anyway, let me finish this. The impact of Hurricane Helene may also impact turnout. So North Carolina is going to be just a really interesting state, I think, to watch 3 weeks from now. But we'll try, maybe third time's the charm, for Gerard Folletti to join us and give us his take over Mark Robinson suing CNN. So, Gerard, are you there?
I am. Third time is the charm. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem at all. So thanks so much for bearing with us and the phones, which don't seem to be in our favor today. But what's your take on this? I mean, I see this more as a PR move 3 weeks out from the election.
It is. I mean, unfortunately, I don't think that the lawsuit is going to have any meaningful outcome, especially not in the near term. We all know that these things drag on for a while, and quite probably it'll get dismissed. But Robinson needs to come out swinging. He needs to convince voters in some way that all these allegations are false, because they have had an effect on him in the polls. I mean, we may not love CNN for its leanings, and I think this was timed politically to hit him and make him suffer in the polls. I think that much is clear. But you know, he needed to file a lawsuit because he's suffering in the polls. He needs to assert his innocence. And what better way to do that than to come out swinging at CNN?
Yeah, and so you know, so he's filing claiming. I mean, this is a defamation lawsuit. So he's claiming that CNN recklessly published these allegations and recklessly disregarding, you know, the truth of the matter that they are reporting on. And so that to me is what's interesting here, because even if something is totally unflattering, if it's true, then even if CNN held it to damage him at a very specific point in time, I mean, that's why we have things called October surprises. And so that in and of itself wouldn't be defamatory if it's actually true, even if it is negative or has a negative impact on his campaign. But there have been reports that that some people who are wanting to help him out of being volunteers, wanting to say, you know, hey, we'll look at this data, have published an independent report. And he has so far, at least according to reports, declined that type of forensic analysis of some of this data. So does that conflict with the lawsuit strategy in terms of a PR analysis?
In some ways, it does. I mean, he did. You're absolutely right. I've seen that same reporting that his campaign staff offered to get an IT forensic specialist to go through and try to disprove that those posts were attributed to him. The irony, and he declined that. Reportedly, the irony is that what he is alleging against CNN is that CNN failed to do that type of forensic analysis. So he's on the one hand refusing to do it, but then he's accusing CNN of failing to do it and publishing recklessly. The problem for him is that, you know, as you pointed out, as a public figure, he needs to prove actual malice. And actual malice means that the statement was published with reckless disregard for the truth. But courts usually come out saying that the mere failure to investigate all sources does not prove actual malice. So for Robinson just to say that CNN should have done a better job investigating it, that's not enough for him to win.
Yeah. So, and of course, if this is just a PR move, I mean, ultimately in 3 weeks, whether he wins or loses, this may not actually be important whether he prevails on the lawsuit itself. And, you know, he seems to me to be taking kind of a page from Donald Trump's playbook, you know, who sued CNN and New York Times and a couple of other outlets heading into the 2020 election for painting him in a false light, you know, defamatory comments that impacted his campaign, all of those things that even, you know, 8 months from the election weren't ultimately resolved until later. And by the time that some of those even were dismissed by the court, it really didn't matter. And so, you know, he got the PR that he needed for that. And so some of this is more strategic timing. But in terms of North Carolina itself, and I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who is the Lawfare Project senior counsel, as I mentioned in the open, you know, North Carolina, especially with this kind of, frankly, damaging report for Mark Robinson, and then everything going on with Hurricane Helene recovery. This is a swing state. Do you see the impact to this state, at least for Republican voters and potentially turnout, because of these two issues simultaneously going on? What do Republicans need to do to try to basically make up for that?
Well, I think here we have to kind of differentiate between Trump and Robinson, because while Robinson may have been affected by this piece, Trump has not been. Trump is still pulling ahead in a lot of the polling that we're seeing in North Carolina, perhaps more so in the wake of the hurricane and the federal government's poor response to it. But the important thing for Trump is to maintain his message, to keep on talking about the economy and how the Biden-Harris and by extension the Harris administration is failing the people of North Carolina. More than that, on a technical level, the campaign needs to be sure that people know where to vote. Because when you're displaced by a hurricane, when everything is shut down, your normal polling places are going to be closed. So Trump really needs to make sure that his people know where to turn out, know where to vote and how to vote. And ironically, that's probably more important for him in North Carolina than actually getting his message out, because messaging-wise, he's doing just fine.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, Gerard Folletti, that, you know, most people, if they're at least even halfway paying attention, you know the differences between Trump and Harris. And, you know, maybe if they don't really know exactly what Harris's policy points are, because she's running on, you know, fumes and vagaries and joy and vibes and whatever, they still at least know a lot of this worldview contrast. And so it really is going to come down to getting out the vote for both sides. And so, you know, we really haven't seen a lot of emphasis on that point from at least the Trump campaign as much, in my opinion, as we've seen from some of the Democrat, you know, machinery. I know the RNC is trying to do that, but how important is that, not just for North Carolina, but for all of these swing states, when we're seeing the polls have such a razor thin margin? And as we've been talking about throughout this program, there's an estimated about 35 million evangelicals who are planning to just sit out and stay home. And that is a critical base for not only the GOP all the way down ticket, but for a lot of these ballot initiatives that are conservative in nature.
Well, that's true. I think that's the you hit the nail on the head. It's not just the presidential election; it's also the ballot initiatives. And we may look and be in awe of the top of the tickets, but it's really the downstate tickets that matter. It's really the down ballot issues in our communities that define the social issues that we face every single day. And for evangelicals, especially, to stay home and not to vote, that's going to send a very bad message, because it really affects how our local communities start adopting policies or not adopting policies that take us in potentially the wrong direction, at least in a direction that most evangelicals seem to oppose. And so if anything, they need that motivation to get out there and vote, even if they're not voting for the top of the ticket. They need to be cautious about the social issues that are on the ballot, hidden as policy initiatives. But for the Republicans especially, they need that evangelical vote to get out there. They need to get out the vote. More so now, we see that Trump's campaign is attuned to the fact that they can't just resist early voting or non-live voting on Election Day. And they've been good about that. They've been good at encouraging people to vote early, to vote by mail where appropriate, which is a change from the last two campaigns. For the Democrats, they're also looking at problems now, because they're not being endorsed by the Arab American Coalition, which is a big deal, especially if a substantial portion of the population in swing states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota, even Pennsylvania, stay home and don't vote for Harris. So both parties are really having a little bit of a struggle getting to the finish line with an important part of their base.
Yeah, so well said. And, you know, this coming just 3 weeks before the election, and Kamala Harris is poised to go on Fox News with that interview with Bret Baier tonight. How important do you think that is for her campaign, and will that move the needle at all?
It's a smart move. I mean, it's one of the biggest criticisms of Harris has been that she is not talking to media, to any media. She doesn't take press conferences. She doesn't take questions. And here she is going into what's perceived as the lion's den to do an interview on Fox News. So I think a lot of people who have questions about her ability to answer questions are being a little bit impressed by the fact that she has that courage. But it remains to be seen whether she can actually meaningfully answer questions, whether Fox does ask her the tough questions that need to be asked, and how that plays with the audience. She has nothing but gain from this experience. No real loss there. Her base is not going to abandon her, and she might swing some votes. And Donald Trump is also doing, you know, a town hall on Fox. It's interesting to see how he is interacting with Fox. But it's up to Harris to make up that deficit of answering questions. So Donald Trump needs to be wary of that, and he needs to be countering that with his messaging and not with personal attacks.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And that interview will air in its entirety, according to Bret Baier, who is the interviewer tonight, on Fox News at 6 p.m. Eastern time. So even though it's pre-recorded, you know, sometimes we even do that on this show, just for guest availability, especially with lawmakers or, you know, personalities that have a higher profile. We have to pre-record, but then we play the entire interview as if it was live, you know, no edits, that kind of thing. And so that is what Fox News tells us will be the situation tonight with Kamala Harris on Brett Baer's program, 6 p.m. Eastern time. And we'll talk about it tomorrow morning for sure and see what we think about how Kamala Harris did. But Gerard Folletti, always really appreciate it. You can follow him on X. And make sure, Christian, you are getting out and voting. Make sure your family, anyone who is eligible, you're bringing them to the polls, and make sure to vote fundamentally for truth. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.